This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll hear Terry's interview with Scott Saul, author of a new book about Richard Pryor. But first, let's listen to the interview Terry recorded with Sarah Koenig, host and executive producer of the podcast Serial. Serial is a spin-off of This American Life, where Sarah was a producer. The 12-episode-long season 1 ended on December 18th, leaving a void in the lives of listeners who waited each week in anticipation of the next installment. Serial is Koenig's reinvestigation of the murder of a Maryland high school student, Haemin Lee, who was strangled to death in 1999. Lee's body was discovered buried in a park. Her schoolmate and ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, was convicted of the murder and is serving a life sentence. Nearly 16 years later, he continues to maintain his innocence. Syed's conviction was based on testimony from his schoolmate Jay, who said Adnan asked for his help after committing the murder. Terry Gross began her interview with Sarah Koenig with this audio from an episode of Serial, in which Jay is responding to a police detective's questions after the body was found. Jay has just told the detective that he picked up Adnan after the murder. Then they got some shovels and drove to the park, where Adnan proceeded to bury Hay.
He asked me if I was going to help, and I told him, and he starts just shoveling dirt on top of him. We leave there,
Let me stop a minute.
Yes.
You helped him dig the hole?
Yes.
How long did it take you both to dig the hole?
20, 25 minutes.
How deep did you make the hole?
Oh, maybe 6 inches at the most. It wasn't very deep at all.
Who did most of the digging?
It was...
Both of you?
Yeah.
Equal work.
I wouldn't say that, but yeah.
Okay.
So those are the key points. Adnan told Jay in advance he was going to do it. He did it. They buried her. Jay's story wasn't just the foundation of the state's case against Adnan. It was the state's case against Adnan. And the picture Jay drew, it's cold. I mean, he's not describing a crime of passion here. This is something much darker. To methodically map out the death of your friend, to strangle her with your own hands, so close up like that. That would mean Adnan wasn't just a killer, but a master liar and manipulator. A psychopath, probably.
But Sarah finds no evidence that Adnan is a psychopath. This gives you some idea of what makes Serial so gripping. You hear actual detective interviews and audio excerpts of the trial, along with many new interviews Sarah conducted, including with Adnan, who spoke to her frequently by phone from prison, and was adamant he did not kill Hay.
No one can ever come with any type of proof or anecdote or anything to ever say that I was ever mad at her, that I was ever angry with her, that I ever threatened her. You know, that's the only thing I can really hold on to. That is like my only firm handhold in this whole thing is that no one's ever been able to prove it. No one ever has been able to provide any shred of evidence that it had anything but friendship towards it, like love and respect for her. That's at the end of the day, man. The only thing I can ever say is, man, I had no reason to kill her.
Sarah guides us through the story, reporting new information she uncovers that apparently neither the defense nor prosecution seem to have been aware of, information that keeps upending her own assumptions about the case and Adnan's guilt or innocence. In the process, we learn things about the criminal justice system that we, or at least I, didn't know. And through Sarah, we reflect on the nature of reasonable doubt and questions like, how can you really know if someone like Adnan, who is popular, smart, and articulate, is capable of murder? Since Sarah raised so many doubts about Adnan's guilt, and since it was such a messy case, listeners caught up in the whodunit aspect of the story speculated somewhat obsessively about what conclusion she would reach. What kept me listening through all 12 episodes wasn't just the case. It was Sarah's and her team's extraordinary reporting and storytelling. Sarah Koenig, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on Serial. It's really just an extraordinary series. So radio has a bigger audience than podcasts do. Nobody expected Serial to have this phenomenal audience that it's attracted. And why do the podcast about a murder, and more specifically about this murder? On the face of it, the murder that you chose to reinvestigate is kind of like your typical case where, you know, maybe the person was wrongfully convicted. My guess is that there's a lot of cases like that. This wasn't a celebrated case. It was a case is from 1999. It's a long time ago. So of all the stories in the world that you could have devoted a year of reporting on, why did you choose this one?
This woman had come to me, Rabia Chaudhry had come to me 2 summers ago now, you know, contacted me. She didn't know me, just, you know, had found my name in the Baltimore Sun clips. And said, you know, could you take a look? I started to look into it just kind of slowly. In other words, it's not like I went out looking for a problematic murder case at all. This came to me. I started looking into it, and I became very interested in it pretty quickly. And I started reporting it just sort of in between other things for This American Life, for the radio show. And so that reporting was already underway. And then sort of simultaneously with that, Julie Snyder and I had started talking about, like, what's some other thing we could do, some other podcast, some other radio show, some project. And we eventually sort of settled on this idea of a serial, which is what I had wanted to do. So what story would we do first? There were a few ideas that popped up, and, you know, I said, well, I got this one I'm already working on. It seems like it's complicated. It seems like it's held my interest in big ways over these many weeks and months. I'd already been working on it. So we sort of thought, okay, let's do it.
So you have really been shouldering an enormous responsibility to the people whose lives you're investigating by investigating this story of an actual murder. Mm-hmm. Adnan Syed, the person who's serving a life sentence now for a murder he says he didn't commit, he has the most to gain from this because now doubt is being raised in a way that it wasn't even raised at the trial about his guilt. You know, maybe he's really not guilty. But at some point, he tells you the downside of your reporting. And in this excerpt from the next to last episode, you read portions of an 18-page single-space type letter that Adnan sent you from prison. And so part of this is you talking to us, the audience, and part of it is you quoting from the letter. So let's hear this excerpt.
Anand is obviously aware of this podcast, that it's out in the world. And I could tell that my story had messed with his equilibrium. When he was convicted of murder, he said the biggest shock for him was that people thought he was capable of this hideous thing, that people didn't believe him. As I look back now, he wrote, I realized there were only 3 things I wanted after I was convicted: to stay close to my family, prove my innocence, and to be seen as a person again, not a monster. The third one, he says he's managed, inside prison. Quote, people in here know me as a stand-up guy. Guards, inmates, staff, people I've been around for 15 years have seen me every day, recognize me as someone whose word can be trusted. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I was able to find the peace of mind in prison that I lost at my trial, unquote. And now I come along, at Rabia's behest, not his, and yank this door open again to the outside world and to all its doubts about Adnan's integrity, stirring up the most painful possible questions about whether he's a monster. It's his nightmare, basically, to be accused of manipulating everyone around him.
So that's an excerpt of Serial. Sarah, were you surprised by that reaction, that there was going to be this downside that he described to you, that people would start thinking, well, maybe he's a monster? People who didn't even know him, who didn't know about the murder, now they know his story, and some of them think he's guilty, some of them think that he's not. But were you expecting that downside to be expressed?
For him to
for
express
him,
it?
For him, yeah. That now, yeah, now people might think, yeah, I'm a monster again. I thought I'd put that behind me.
Right.
And now these, yeah, doubts are being raised again.
Yeah. No, I wasn't. I could tell something was affecting him a little bit, I think, before this. So I knew something was up a little bit, and then I got that letter, and it was a little disjointed, which is unlike him, you know? I could tell he was upset. And it was a really long letter. And it's sort of what I was saying earlier, where it was sort of like when I realized how many people were listening and how carefully people were listening. And Adnan had started to get lots of letters from people, you know, from strangers, you know, from some people he knew, but from strangers, you know. And, you know, the guards, some of the guards are listening and talking to him about, I mean, he can't hear it, but the guards are hearing it and talking to him about it. And so I think he just, it overcame him a little bit. And what to me what was interesting about the letter was what it explained. There's another part in the podcast that happens before this where he asks me like, why are you doing this story? This is before it had started to air, and he was like, can you just explain to me again like what we're doing and why? And I wasn't totally prepared for that question, and so I sort of explained, you know, my interest, and also said, and also just because like I started talking to you and like I like talking to you and you seem like a good guy and stuff. And his reaction was so surprising. Like it took me aback so much where he was just like, you don't even know me.
Oh,
like,
we have that clip ready. Let me play that because I think it would be very dramatic to hear it. So here's Adnan reacting to you telling him that that you think he's a nice guy who isn't the type who would commit a murder.
I mean, you don't even really know me, though, Koenig. You don't. Maybe you do. Maybe. I mean, you know, I don't. We only talk on the phone. I don't understand what you mean. It's just weird to hear you say that because I don't even really know you.
But wait, are you saying you don't think that I know you at all?
I mean, for you to say that I'm a great person, I mean, like a nice person, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. Like, I've only talked to you on the phone a few times. I guess you investigated me back then.
Okay, so to prove how much you don't know each other, he calls you Koenig when your name is Koenig. So he doesn't even know how to pronounce your name. But
right. But
he kind of proves a point in that you make throughout Serial, which is it's hard to judge a person and whether they're capable of murder based on what you know of them. People are surprising, especially if you don't know somebody well and you didn't know him that well.
So can I just sort of connect this back to the thing I was saying before?
Yes, please.
About the letter?
Yeah.
So I was really taken aback when he said that, and you can hear me sort of laugh for a second, which is totally nervous laughter on my part, where I'm just like, what's happening, you know? And so when I got the letter, which was months later, you know, after the podcast had started coming, that's when I understood what had happened in that moment that you just played, which is he had made all of this effort. He's so scared of being labeled a manipulator that he felt like he's savvy, he's smart. So he knew that every interaction with me would be viewed as in the same way, not only by me, but by anyone hearing it. So he tried so, so hard to have it just be about the case and just be about what happened and sort of the facts of the case. And he felt like as long as I stick to the facts of the case, I'm safe because these are things that are showable and provable one way or the other. So I won't be accused of being a manipulator.
And I should mention here that the judge accused him of being a manipulator. So
yes,
I think he's especially sensitive about that.
And strong terms. Mm-hmm. And so when I said that to him, like, you seem like a nice guy, he was just like, oh, God, you know, here we go again.
Right.
Here we go again. All this is going to end up in the same place where people are just going to say, oh, he manipulated you.
My guest is Sarah Koenig, the host and executive producer of the podcast Serial, in which she reinvestigates a 1999 murder of a high school student. Her ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, was convicted of murder and is serving a life sentence. Serial includes recorded excerpts of Adnan's phone calls to Sarah from prison. So
Adnan was not able to hear the podcast in prison. I think he was able to read transcripts. Do I have that right?
Yeah, he's read, I don't know how many transcripts he's read, and I don't totally know who's sending him the transcripts, because we're not, but I think he's read a bunch of them. I don't know how many.
Why can't he listen to the podcast? Is that his choice, or is he not allowed to?
They don't have internet. He doesn't have internet. So,
and no one can like download it from the outside and bring it to him.
Well, he has nothing. He has a, what does he have? Xbox. He has like one of those game things for the TV. And apparently you can play like a CD on it. So at one point I said, you know, I can burn them onto CDs for you and send you those. I think he has to get special permission to receive a CD. And he said, yeah, I'll let you know when I get the permission. But he's never done that. And I don't know. I don't know if part of him doesn't want to hear it, that he'd rather read it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We've argued about that, actually.
About whether he should hear it or not?
Yeah. Because I'm like, it's meant to be heard. And he's like, no, I want to see it in its purest form on paper. And I'm like, no, you're missing a ton.
Right.
You're missing all kinds of nuance that is happening in people's voices, or he's taking stuff at face value that I say, that I'm like, no, if you heard the way I say it, you'd hear that it's like in passing, or it's like I'm being ironic or whatever. And he's just like, no, you don't get it. You don't get it that the real version is on paper. Like we had a total, and I was like, you don't understand radio. And he's like, you don't understand science. You know, I don't know. So we've actually argued about that.
I'm sure part of what was really weighing on you during the time you were reporting the story on Serial was it you had people's lives in your hands. I mean, in some ways, you're discussing Adnan's guilt or innocence. He's serving a life sentence in prison after being convicted of murder. But the person who convicted him, Jay, you really throw a lot of doubt on his story. Jay's story got Adnan convicted because Jay says Adnan called him and said, I'm going to murder my ex-girlfriend, Hay, and asked Jay to help him bury the body. Jay says he did. Jay took the police to where the car was. So I wouldn't want to be Jay right now. I wouldn't want to be Jay listening to this podcast, because a lot of people think, well, maybe Jay did it, and maybe he's just trying to put the blame on Adnan. And I guess I'm wondering what you felt your responsibility to Jay was while reporting the piece.
You know, obviously we thought a lot about that. And I want to be clear, like, we're never saying Jay did it or maybe Jay did it. And I don't believe that. So I think it's hard. I don't think it's any different from any other story like this where you're reinvestigating a case. You know, it's not sort of groundbreaking in some way that we're sort of bringing up, you know, like, look, there may have been problems with this case. So I think we all felt like it's worth asking these questions. You know, it's worth... These are important questions, and there seem to be problems with this case, and the alternative is to not ask these questions and do nothing, and that didn't seem right. So it just was a matter of, you know, trying as hard as we could to get everyone to participate, including Jay, and you know, I understand why he didn't. I totally understand why he didn't, but that doesn't mean... If he doesn't, then we can't do the story. You know, we're going to still do the story because the questions are still there. And so it was just a matter of being as respectful as we could and as accurate as we could. And, you know, we certainly didn't bring up anything that we didn't think was necessary in order to tell this story. We didn't bring up extraneous stuff that seemed like, you know, like, why? You know, just it was everything that was already there in court, in open court, and in fact, in a harsher way than we were presenting it, frankly. So obviously, I don't want anyone to suffer because of the work I'm doing, But I also feel like, you know, there's a strong tradition of doing these kinds of investigative stories, and we weren't doing anything differently than we would do in any other story.
My guest is Sarah Koenig, the host and executive producer of the podcast Serial, in which she reinvestigates the 1999 murder of a high school student. The girl's ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, was convicted of murder and is serving a life sentence, but he continues to maintain his innocence. Listeners caught up in the whodunit aspect of the story speculated somewhat obsessively about what conclusion Sarah would reach. The person with the most at stake, Adnan, was wondering too. In the final installment, Adnan offered Sarah some advice about how to end Serial.
I was just thinking it the other day. I said, I'm pretty sure she probably has people telling her, like, look, this case, he's probably guilty. You're going crazy trying to find out that he's innocent, which you're not going to find because he's guilty. I mean, I don't think you'll ever have a 100% or you know what I'm saying, any type of certainty about it. The only person in the whole world who can have that is me. And, I mean, for what it's worth, whoever did it, you know, you'll never have that. I don't think you will.
Adnan told me all he wanted was to take the narrative back from the prosecution, just as an exercise, so people could see his case without makeup on, look at it in the eye, up close, and make their own judgments. He told me he doesn't think I should weigh in.
I think you should just go down the middle. I think you shouldn't really take a side. I mean, it's not, you know, obviously, you know what I'm saying, my decision or whatever, obviously it's yours, but I'm saying, if I was to be you, just go down the middle. Hey, you know, obviously you know how to narrate it, but I checked these things out, and these are the things that look bad against him. These are the things that, you know, the state doesn't really have an answer for. You know what I mean? And I think in a way you could even go point for point. And in a sense, you leave it up to the audience to determine.
While I appreciate Adnan's blessing to take a powder, I'm not going to.
You know, I think there was such a burden on you from the audience. So many people in the audience were like, what's the ending of Serial going to be? Is she going to say who really did it? Is she going to give us her opinion of who really did it? And some people were like demanding closure, like, I want an ending. I want a satisfying ending. And your responsibility, of course, is to the truth that you were capable of reporting. What kind of burden did you feel about having an ending and what the implications of an ending could be for people who are alive now?
I mean, it's funny. I did not fret about the ending that much. I always just felt like I'm just going to keep my head down and keep reporting and keep reporting and keep reporting, and it'll come to an end, as all stories do. And the reporting's going to take me there. It's like I can't pre-engineer this, right? So it's funny, like, I think, I can't remember when it was, but it was like after maybe episode 3 or 4, we were having a meeting. I was having a meeting with Julie Snyder, the executive producer, and I think Dana was there too, Dana Chivas, who's also a producer. And Ira Glass came in, who's like our boss, you know, and Julie said, Ira says he has some ideas about the ending. And we were like, oh, great, like, let's hear it. So he sort of came in and more or less said, like, so I think it'd be great if you guys, like, solved it. Like, we were like, wait, that's your idea for the, okay, we'll do our best, you know. But so that was a little disconcerting. But, you know, we know how to make stories on This American Life. You know, we've all been doing it for a really long time. And it just felt like we'll get somewhere, and it's not going to please everyone, but that's too, you know, tough luck. I can't, you know what I mean? Like, we couldn't make something that just because people wanted to hear that something.
And I'll say, for people who are still listening to the series and haven't finished yet, we're giving away information about the ending. I don't think that will really ruin anyone's interest in the series, because it's the way you tell the story and how the information unfolds is just so gripping. So in a way, I'd say don't even worry about the spoilers here for those of you who are listening. But now I'm going to mention the conclusion that you do come to. You say, as a juror, I'd have to acquit Adnan Syed as a human being walking down the street next week. What do I think? If you asked me to swear that Adnan Syed is innocent, I couldn't do that. I nurse doubt. And I was really glad you made that distinction between the legal definition of not guilty and the doubts that you have as just a person. And I thought that was a wonderful way to end, because you're kind of, I think, implicitly condemning or at least criticizing the criminal justice system's functioning for this trial because there are so many reasonable doubts.
Yeah, to me there certainly were. To me there were. And I think we all found that frustrating. You know, all of us who were working on it found it, you know, people are like, what's the most surprising thing, you know, you found out as you went along? Like a couple of people asked me that. And like, so far my answer has been, you know, this kind of boring thing, like this boring technical thing, but it was so fundamental to me, which is like when we realized that the way that, you know, the star witnesses testimony was being corroborated, like the main way was with these cell records. And when we realized like the phone records of the day of the crime don't actually support the story that he's telling in any solid way, that to me was like, what? Wait, whoa. You know, like with the, and so yeah, it just, and I felt like that really didn't come through at trial, that the cell records, they were really presented as this bedrock thing that was like this, you know, rock underneath the story that completely held it up. And we just found that that was not true.
Did the popularity of Serial mess with your mind? I really doubt you expected it to be that popular. It broke all records in podcasting. It's been written up all over. It's been like number one, I think, in Sweden and in England in terms of podcasting. Did that affect your own equilibrium?
Yes. It did. And this is just like a thing of my own personality, I think, is that it affected it negatively, mostly, largely. it was stressful, and I also tend to focus on the negative, as my colleagues probably kind of do. So I, you know, in the beginning, you know, when we were just like, well, you know, how's it going? And there started to be press about it. I was reading a lot, you know, and sort of Googling it several times a day, like, what's new? What are people saying? And that just started to be bad for me. So I kind of stopped, honestly. I really stopped.
Why was it bad? Through.
Oh, because I'm thin-skinned, like, in a way that's just dumb. You know, I mean, you know, it's hard. It's doing this work, you would think that I should be able to get as good as I give. Somehow it was a little, you know, it was just hard. You know, it's hard to, it's, I don't, you know, I take criticism personally. And so that was sometimes hard. I mean, in another level, it was really, I think, good for me as a reporter and good for the story insofar as it was just a constant reminder of how careful we needed to be. And it's not as if we weren't already being extraordinarily careful, you know, but it just was a sort of constant. To have that much scrutiny on the reporting that you're doing, especially when you're not done with it yet, was really, I mean, it really makes you work harder.
Sarah Koenig is the host and executive producer of Serial, the podcast spinoff of This American Life. She spoke with Terry Gross on December 22nd. The following week, an interview with Jay, the state's star witness in the case against Adnan Syed, was published by the website The Intercept. You'll find a longer version of Terry's conversation with Sarah Koenig online at freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Scott Saul discusses his new book about Richard Pryor. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Scott Saul, author of the book Becoming Richard Pryor. So many comics today would not be doing the kind of comedy they're doing without Richard Pryor's example. Pryor took the most difficult, troubling aspects of his life and turned them into comedy, including jokes about setting himself on fire freebasing. Pryor talked about being black in ways that had never been done before in mainstream entertainment. and he was fearless and hilarious talking about race relations. Becoming Richard Pryor traces how Pryor went from being raised by a grandmother who was a bootlegger and madam in Peoria, Illinois, to being a transformative figure in entertainment. The tricky thing in presenting this interview was finding Richard Pryor recordings that we can play on the radio. So we have a few selections that have a comparatively small number of expletives. And we did some editing and some bleeping, as you'll hear. Let's start with a track from Pryor's 1974 album.
Cops put a hurting on your ass, man, you know. They really degrade you. White folks don't believe cops degrade. Oh, come on, those beatings, those people are resisting arrest. I'm tired of this harassment of police officers. Because the police live in your neighborhood, see? And you be known them as Officer Timpson.
Hello, Officer Timpson, going bowling tonight? Yes, nice pinto you have.
N****s don't know him like that. See, white folks get a ticket, they pull over.
Hey, officer, yes, glad to be of help.
N****s got to be talking about, I am reaching into my pocket for my license. Because I don't want to be no accident.
That's from Richard Pryor's 1974 album, That N-Word's Crazy. Scott Saul, welcome to Fresh Air. It's kind of sad how current that sounds today.
Indeed. I think that Pryor was so unusual and pioneering in that he really spoke for black working class communities across America. And things have not changed so much.
You know, the track that we just played is from his album, That N-Word's Crazy. And the mm-hmm. N-word is a word he used a lot, both in album titles and, of course, in his comedy. And I'm wondering if that was a word that was used against him a lot, for instance, when he was growing up, and what you learned about his decision to take that word and use it himself and use it, you know, use it on stage in his comedy, use it in his albums, and kind of own it in the way he wanted to.
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up black in Peoria, you know, blacks were only 10% of Peoria, Illinois at the time. He was very much picked on, harassed, and abused with that word. And so, for example, and when he's in seventh grade, you know, he's getting teased mercilessly by his white classmates. He's basically the only black kid in that class. And he comes to his teacher at lunchtime, and he's crying. And he says to her, you know, she asks him why he's crying. He says, well, they called me and he uses the N-word. And then she says back to him, well, that's what you are. You know, get along now. Go back to your seat. Finish your lunch and class begin. So he's getting that from all sides when he's growing up, and it continues, you know, through his experience in the Army and so on.
Why did you want to write a biography of Richard Pryor?
Well, there are a few answers to that question. The long answer, in terms of going back way into my history, is that I was growing up when I was 10 years old, and I was just fascinated by this figure of Richard Pryor, who I was watching through the buddy comedies that he was making with Gene Wilder, things like Silver Streak and Stir Crazy. And as a white Jewish kid growing up in the San Fernando Valley, very suburban, you know, I identified, frankly, with the nebbish that was Gene Wilder. And in those movies, Gene Wilder needs Richard Pryor to cut a window on a new reality, to show him the world as it really is, and to jolt him out of his nebbishhood. And so from then start, I kind of understood that if I wanted to understand the full world I lived in, somehow Richard Pryor was going to help me do that. A more specific answer in terms of how I started actually researching the writing of the book has to do with the enigma of Richard Pryor's time in Berkeley. Earlier biographers had said that Pryor landed in Berkeley at some point. It was unclear exactly when, 69, 70, 71, and that he came here on some kind of exile, and he experimented. And he came to Berkeley still living in the shadow of Bill Cosby, and that after he left Berkeley, he was a new kind of comedian. And Pryor said something similar in his memoir. And so the question for me was, well, what really happened in Berkeley?
In investigating the Berkeley period of Richard Pryor's life in around 1971, you tracked down somebody named Alan Farley, who had been Richard Pryor's roommate during that period and who had a radio show on the Pacifica station in the Bay Area. What did you get from Alan Farley? He gave you access to some of his tapes?
Right, so he had about 8 hours of tapes, and these embraced all different sorts of recordings. I mean, some of them were shows that he had done at local clubs, Richard Pryor shows at local clubs. Some of them were these very odd experiments, almost avant-garde experiments, a sound collage done in the wake of the Attica prison riot. Some of them were scenarios for films. And what they really gave me was a sense of just how experimental Richard Pryor became when he was in Berkeley. These were not the tapes that would be of like a comedian trying to polish his material. These were the tapes coming from an artist who was really searching for his form and experimenting and trying to do anything that could respond to the insanity of American life in 1971.
So let's hear an excerpt of this tape from 1971, and we're going to hear Richard Pryor doing two different takes on the premise, you are the only African-American at a party.
Could I get a drink? Oh, I don't know, you have any watermelon juice? I'm just playing, man. Well, you seem so aware to me, you know, you come on, so I was playing, man. Man, I was just playing. Oh, no, man, I'm not hostile or nothing like that. Don't say that. I ain't gonna say I'm hostile, man. All I said, I was playing. I was making a joke, man. Well, you invited me to the party, man, and I was just ordering a drink. I was playing. I like some scotch on the rocks. Well, now you're gonna get mad. You're looking funny. Why is your wife looking at me in that tone of voice? Well, your wife's keep checking me out, man. I ain't gonna do it. I don't like white women. I'm playing, man. Did you know nothing about playing? How many niggas you know? I'm the only one? And you're not sure if I'm a nigga or not? Well, allow me to introduce myself. What you mean I can't pull my pants down? Is that 30 seconds? We'll keep going on. Sure is happy to be at this party. See, I was in a party back in 1925. That's the first party I ever been to. With all white folks. See, I know how to handle myself in a crowd of white folks. See, I'm not prejudiced, none of that. See, they don't wear me. See, I studies people. I be at a party with people. I know how to act. You have to tell me. You don't have to have me no drink on no tray. I ain't gonna spill it. You have to bring me a bunch of drinks like that, man. I take a drink one at a time. I'm like everybody else. Well, didn't nobody else take two or three drinks, man? Come over with a tray of drinks dressed in that old funny suit. Don't be playing that with me. That ain't my style. I want the bottle. Sitting right here. I don't drink out no glass. I'm sociable.
So that's Richard Pryor doing some improv that happened to be recorded in 1971. And that was a tape that was made by Pryor's roommate at the time, Alan Farley, who was working at a Pacifica radio station at the time, KPFA. And my guest, Scott Saul, got access to that tape. Scott Saul is the author of a new biography of Richard Pryor called Becoming Richard Pryor. So when I hear that tape that we just heard, mm-hmm. I hear Richard Pryor doing two really different takes on the improv that was thrown on him, on the suggestion that was thrown at him. Two totally different characters who speak completely differently, who come from different backgrounds. So I hear him trying to like embody different characters and be very much in the moment, as improv asks you to do. What do you hear when you listen back to that?
Something very similar. I mean, I think one thing that I think has been less acknowledged is how much Pryor was shaped by improv. You know, he came to New York City, Greenwich Village, at a time when these new ideas about, you know, collective improvisation and comedy are really taking off. And that's where he spends his comic apprenticeship. So he takes that, you know, out of Greenwich Village and into his stand-up. And instead of having, you know, if you're doing group improv, you're riffing off of other people, he'll do a lot of that himself. and he'll incarnate, you know, character after character. So what we hear there is, you know, the first bit, it's somebody who's closer to Pryor himself, you know, and he's kind of playing with asking the white people in the room to learn how to play with him, to learn how to accept these kind of teasing jokes that are going to play with the caricatures of blackness that are in circulation. In the second part, we're hearing him take on the voice of the character he called the Wino, which is this person who's older, who has a great amount of braggadocio. So he had that capacity to fling himself into character again and again, and he loved it. I mean, I think he loved that feeling of losing himself in character.
The impression I get through your book is that as Richard Pryor is developing a better sense of himself as a comic and as a person, that his personal life is often on the verge of really falling apart. You know, divorces, incidents where he beats the woman in his life. Talk a little bit about that side of his life, about the difficulties that he had.
Yeah, I think he had a very chaotic inner life. You know, he was somebody who really struggled to ever be at peace. And I don't know that he really had an integrated sense of self, in the sense that I think he might have, you know, been one of the most conflicted people, you know, to ever live. You know, just he wanted so many things, and he had just so many ambivalences swirling through him. And so he was always bursting out, you know, in all kinds of forms of violence, in terms of the people who got too close. You know, he said once that, you know, it's easier for him to talk about his life in front of 2,000 people than it is to do it one-on-one. He said, you know, I'm a really, really defensive person because if you were sensitive in my neighborhood, you were something to eat. So on the one hand, when he goes on stage, he can be vulnerable. He can reveal so many things about himself. But then when he pulls into these intimate relationships, he becomes even more barbed. And the people, especially the women who get to know him really up close, in some ways see the worst of him.
Did you interview those women, any of those women?
I did. You know, the one who left a really strong impression on me was Patricia Heitman, who was his companion from his time in Berkeley in 1971 through 1975. So kind of was with him in these really crucial years where he, you know, forms that new act that, you know, gets him to kind of revolutionize American comedy, and when he's also, you know, becoming a real Hollywood draw.
And what did she tell you?
Well, I mean, she's an incredibly self-possessed and impressive woman in the kind of the intelligence with which she remembers her life and the specifics of what she experienced with Richard. And part of what she remembers is just so vividly their life. And actually, when I met her on the grounds of Yamashiro, which is a Japanese restaurant, and they lived in the cottage, so we kind of were stepping through the life that she lived with Richard. And she even took me on a little tour of that cottage. And I could see, for example, the door that Richard Pryor had attacked with a hatchet when he was trying to get her so he could, you know, beat her. She showed me these kinds of things.
It sounds like Richard Pryor could be very difficult to work with. When he was on Saturday Night, this was early in the Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. Saturday Night Live show's history when it was still called Saturday Night, Lorne Michaels decided to, without telling Richard Pryor, institute a 7-second delay for that broadcast only because he was afraid that Richard Pryor would use language that you really can't get away with using on broadcast.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I
think
that
why did he have to
Richard
keep it secret from Richard Pryor?
Well, Richard Pryor hated censorship. He hated euphemisms. He hated dancing around the truth. And I think that, you know, ever since that moment when he decides to embrace characters, to embrace the pursuit of character in his stand-up, he wants to be able to throw himself into that act of projection, of becoming the character. And the kind of characters he's going to become, a lot of them are going to use all kinds of language. And he doesn't want to have to censor himself as he's incarnating those characters. So I think it was just it was a very deep part of his creative process to follow those impulses. So the idea that he would have to censor himself on this show that's aspiring to be super hip and cutting-edge comedy in America, I think to him that would have just, really, really cramped his style.
We started our interview by talking about how Richard Pryor had the N-word used against him when he was growing up, and how he used that word himself in his routines and kind of like used it with defiance and used it in different ways, like you pointed out. Then he made this decision later in his career to stop using that word. And he has a comedy sketch about it from his 1982 Live on the Sunset Strip recording that's about his trip to Africa and how that led him to decide not to use the N-word. I know that goes past the place where your book ends, but what do you know about that decision in his life?
Yeah. I think that moment in Africa is kind of a religious epiphany of a sort, where he realizes that the N-word has been used to degrade people and that they should be free of any trace of degradation, that there's a deep sacredness to every person. And so they should kind of escape words like that are used to dehumanize them. I think that's what he's doing at that moment when he says, I'm not going to use that word again. Now, a few years later, he does bring it back into his act. It was just too useful to him. It was a word that was so important to the kind of black working class world that he had grown up in, and it was deeply ingrained in his person, too.
Scott Saul is an associate professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the new book, Becoming Richard Pryor. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.